It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Give me a P. Give me another P. And an I. What do you got? J. Powell's continuing nightmare is what you got. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 14th of December. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, the acronym of the day. Yes, I know technically it's an initialism. Anyway, it's PPI, the Producer Price Index, inflation at the wholesale level, what businesses are paying for inventory and raw materials, all the stuff that goes into the finished goods that you and I buy at retail. In November, those produced prices were up 9.6% over a year ago, so said the Bureau of Labor Statistics this morning, which means you've certainly heard it. So far today. To be clear, though, ain't nobody was surprised, up to and including Fed Chair Jay Powell. Question now is, as the Fed meets today and tomorrow on the state of this economy, what can they do about it? Marketplace's Samantha Field gets us going.
There's actually a lot the Fed can do to reduce inflation.
They can stop buying long-term bonds, which they've been doing, and they can stop it quicker.
Joe Gagneau is at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
And then they could also raise interest rates.
Doing both would eventually mean there's less money floating around in the economy that people can borrow for cheap to buy houses and cars and other things. If there are fewer people buying things, prices will start to come down eventually.
Even if the Fed begins acting today, it may be a number of months before we see the impact.
Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust. He says for all the power the Fed has, and it's a lot, it doesn't have any power over COVID.
COVID-19 is an understated contributor to various types of inflation that we're experiencing today.
As long as the virus is raging, factories will continue to close, ports around the world will be jammed, and there will be more demand than supply. So,
a continued worldwide effort to combat the pandemic may be the best thing for getting inflation back under control.
While the Fed can't solve those supply chain issues or get more people vaccinated, Ann Owen, an economics professor at Hamilton College, says it can manage people's expectations about inflation by saying, hey, we're going to do something about this.
And that's actually an important part of managing inflation. If we can keep inflation expectations low, it will mean that inflation will be lower.
Because, she says, what people think inflation will be in the future influences their behavior in the present.
Employers may be feeling some pressure to increase wages, or perhaps if you're a company and you sell consumer goods and you're setting your prices, maybe you'll set those prices higher.
If the Fed can convince people that inflation's under control, Owen says, maybe soon it will be. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, mostly down, waiting, one supposes, for word from the Fed tomorrow. Expectations, as Sam was just saying, am I right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, here's a story from the Marketplace desk of Be Careful What You Wish For. The International Energy Agency was out with its monthly crude oil report today. The IEA says Omicron and whatever economic contagion it might bring should let oil supply catch up to demand. So oil markets won't be as tight as they have been, which could mean cheaper gasoline and lower electricity bills. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reminds us, more petroleum supply kind of does damage to that whole clean energy transition thing, right?
President Joe Biden's been talking about ways to get gas prices down for a minute now, even releasing some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve last month. At the same time, he's been promoting his clean energy agenda and saying we need to stop using so much oil and gas. Michael Lynch at the Energy Policy Research Foundation in Washington says that messaging is confusing.
If you look up cognitive dissonance in the dictionary, you'll see a picture of Joe Biden at COP26 in Glasgow saying, oh, by the way, OPEC, we want more oil to bring prices down while pledging to reduce fossil fuel consumption in the long run.
This is the short-term versus long-term conundrum. We're all still dependent on fossil fuels around the world, but countries are also pledging to phase them out. Melissa Lott at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy says we have to recognize both realities.
We need to think about how we're setting up our policies and our technologies and our systems to reach net zero as quickly as possible. At the same time, we can't have skyrocketing bills. We can't have people struggling to be able to fill their tanks, to be able to keep their homes warm.
That's another conundrum, cheap and reliable energy versus the immediate need to curb emissions. Caught in the middle of this are consumers, yes, but also American energy companies. Robert Johnston is managing director for Eurasia Group's Energy, Climate, and Resources Practice. He says the energy industry is divided on the best approach.
Do we keep producing while trying to decarbonize the barrels, or like some of the European companies, do we think about starting to invest in sort of non-fossil fuel businesses like, you know, renewable electricity, green hydrogen, or biofuels?
Johnston says right now there's a disconnect between what the CEOs of those big oil companies think Washington is telling them and the message that the White House thinks it's delivering. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Tell you what, couldn't get a much better segue from one story to another if we tried. Out of an oil and gas piece to cars. Retail sales figures come out tomorrow, including new car sales, and still, chip shortages and the morass that is the global supply chain mean shopping for a new car is not for the faint of heart. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has been making some calls.
A few months before Troy Bratton and his wife were expecting their new baby, they put down a deposit on a new Kia Telluride. The baby arrived. No sign of the SUV.
That was supposed to come within 90 days, but it's been almost 4 months now.
So plan B, he's shopping around again in the Denver area.
When we go to car lots, they look like they're not even in business. They're just empty.
Eric Nelson's been having the same experience trying to buy a car for his teenage son in Houston.
So you go into the showroom and it's like, well, we'd like to test drive something. And they're sort of, we don't have anything.
With few options on the new car market, Nelson ended up buying used and spending more than he wanted.
Let's just find something and hope when my youngest one turns 16, it's back to the old days.
He probably shouldn't count on that, says analyst Michelle Krebs with Cox Automotive.
We don't ever anticipate it's going to be normal like it was before with an abundance of inventory.
Krebs says dealerships would lose money on their old business model of packing their lots and showrooms with vehicles.
What the automakers and dealers have found is their profits are better if they keep supply more in line with demand.
Not that they're in line right now. Krebs says the chip shortage will last well into next year, and in the meantime, buyers can't afford to be picky. On the flip side, she says if you have a car to give up, dealerships will pay top dollar. That's what Brett Williams found when he traded in his sports car for a Toyota Tacoma in Austin.
I got an offer that was over the Kelley Blue Book.
But he had to make some compromises. Four doors instead of two, and a darker gray than he was hoping for. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Should you be the DIY type, maybe replacing a toilet? Or refinishing your floors? You, of course, already know you can learn how to do just about anything if you watch enough videos online. And you might think, from all the resources out there, that we've become a whole nation of do-it-yourselfers. And in point of fact, the $46 billion Americans spent on DIY projects when the census last counted, which was 2019, is likely to be higher when the numbers come out for this year. But turns out, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that the growth in do-it-yourself that we have seen in this pandemic economy is actually a break from a long-term trend.
In a workshop at the Station North Tool Library near downtown Baltimore, half a dozen students are getting a lesson in tools and skills for home renovation, from a basic power drill to a miter saw to a jigsaw. Several of the students are new homeowners, like 31-year-old Jacqueline Wood. She's a medical resident who bought a 100-year-old row house in April.
I've done a couple of projects by myself with the help of the internet, but wanted a little more guidance on how to do slightly more difficult things so that I don't have to get a handyman every time I need to do something.
Nate Hetzler, also 31 and also a new homeowner, has a very specific project in mind.
My grandfather passed away like last year and got a mirror from him. And so I've just had this mirror just like sitting around and like haven't been able to hang it because I don't know like how to drill into a brick wall between my house and my neighbor's house.
The Tool Library opened in 2013, a place where people could pay a small membership fee and borrow anything from rakes and garden shears to grinders, sanders, and welders. Co-director Jessa Wace says pretty early on, the founders noticed something.
People would go to borrow their tools and get extension cords and then run the cords out into the alley and work on their projects in our alley. So that told us, you know, maybe there is a need in this city for affordable space to work on your project, too.
So they added a couple workshops and a host of classes, joinery, knife making, tiling, and plumbing. Wace says the home repair classes are among the most popular. Everything shut down for a while early in the pandemic.
And since bringing those classes back, almost every single one has filled within a week.
I don't have to tell you DIY home improvement has taken off during the pandemic, but what's surprising is how it's kept up. Grant Farnsworth tracks the industry with the Farnsworth Group, a market research firm. He says one reason may be inflation.
Those that have not hired, a large chunk of them said, one, either I couldn't get a hold of the contractor, or I can do it cheaper myself.
The question is how long the DIY boom will last. Before the pandemic, Americans were actually growing less interested in doing it ourselves. Abby Will follows home improvement trends at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. She says in 1999, more than 41% of improvement projects were DIY. In 2019, that had fallen to 37%. And when it comes to home improvement spending,
the share for DIY projects had been declining steadily before the pandemic.
There are several reasons for that, she says. One is that homeowners overall are older and maybe less inclined to swing a sledgehammer or climb a ladder. Rising prices have kept a lot of younger people from becoming homeowners. Our houses are older, too, and need bigger repairs that require professionals, new roofs or foundation work.
I think all of those factors will continue to pull on the DIY share of home improvement spending and, you know, potentially revert back to kind of these longer term trends.
But in this class in Baltimore, the DIY urge is going strong. Maria Bontigawan is 68 years old and recently moved to Baltimore from California in hopes of finally affording her own house.
You know, you pay a workman to put up your curtains. It's like, I could do that myself if I only knew how to use a drill.
So tonight, she drills, or tries to. Without a trace of judgment, instructor Dre Cortez notices she's put in a screwdriver bit.
So this is only when you have a hole ready. Okay. In order to create a hole, I want you to practice using this one.
Okay. So
Bontigawan switches the bit and starts out gingerly.
Should I let it rip or just do...
Go for it.
Okay. She lets it rip and drills a perfect hole in a board.
How's it feel?
It feels great.
She'll be hanging curtains in no time. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace.
Coming up.
We don't necessarily want to see so many holes in the ground.
No, we necessarily don't, I think. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 106 points today, 0.3%, 35,544. The NASDAQ shed 175 points. That's about 1.1%. Percentage-wise, ended things at 15,237. The S&P 500 down 34 points, about 0.7%, 46.34. Meme stocks, you know those ones that we've told you about? Cult-like followings on social media, some of them have. They bounced back from their steep slide yesterday. GameStop rebounded almost 8%. AMC Entertainment improved 5.4%. Apple down 0.8% today. The tech giant announced today it's going to require customers at all of its U.S. stores wear a mask in response to, obviously, Omicron and the spread of COVID-19. The rule will apply even in parts of the country that don't impose a mask requirement, so forewarned is forearmed. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Maybe the biggest, and if not the biggest, then definitely like top three business imperatives right now the companies have to deal with is figuring out a way to deal with the supply chain. There are some companies that kind of have figured it out. They're not just weathering the supply chain nightmare. They've figured out a way to profit from it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains how they are doing it.
About a month ago, Thompson Creek Window Company, a mid-sized Maryland firm, started running this ad.
Thompson Creek does it all. Design, build, and install, which means no supply chain delays like other window dealers. Home
sweet home. Thompson Creek is headquartered in Upper Marlboro, which is in the greater Washington, D.C. area.
Hello, how are you, Rick?
Hi, Nancy. Very well.
CEO Rick Wiest says they got the idea for their supply chain ads at a marketing meeting a few months into the pandemic. They realized that having their own factory and sourcing 90% of their raw materials in the U.S. was a distinct advantage and selling point, especially for consumers with an immediate window problem.
We can solve it in 5 weeks, or, you know, you can call the other guy and 6 months from now, they'll be out.
Wiest says the message is getting through. This year, their business is up 40% so far.
We saw that opportunity and seized the window of opportunity.
No pun intended.
Plenty of pun intended.
Thompson Creek's offices and customer service department are on one side of a door, which Wiest opens.
So come on in. We're coming into the window factory.
Rows and rows of white vinyl strips wait to be cut and finished in saws and sanders. Weiss tells me they buy their bulky raw materials like vinyl and glass domestically, and at the start of the pandemic, they managed to stockpile some of the small parts they do import, like window locks. Other very different kinds of companies are also working this supply chain advantage, like Veritiv, which designs and sells packaging materials. They're headquartered in Atlanta, so we connected on Zoom.
We're recording. And can you hear me okay, Dan?
Yeah, great.
Dan Calderwood is a senior vice president at Veritiv. Like Thompson Creek, Veritiv gets about 90% of its materials from American suppliers. And Calderwood says that's a real selling point for desperate customers who can't get shipping supplies right now. Veritiv works with companies who need to redesign their packaging around raw materials they can get in the U.S.
Our phones have been ringing off the hook with customers saying, I can't get the packaging I need for my holiday orders. So we've been really active around that recently.
And it's paid off. Calderwood says sales were up about 11% through the third quarter of this year. Even companies that don't rely on the supply chain for their products still need packaging, like Tradesy, a peer-to-peer website connecting buyers and sellers of secondhand luxury clothing and accessories. Tradesy ran short of the recycled boxes it uses, but at least the stuff it sells comes from someone's closet, not the clogged supply chain, says founder and CEO Tracy D'Annunzio.
Many of our sellers have put in their listings and in their seller profiles how quickly they ship and assurances to buyers that they have the product and there won't be any supply chain issues.
D'Annunzio says customers are responding. Gift sales are up 66% over last year. She adds that almost a quarter of the messages between Tradesy buyers and sellers last month mentioned shipping times and or the supply chain. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Andy Euler was talking oil earlier from our outpost in Austin. Way out west in Texas, it's water that's the issue, at least as much as it is oil. 81% of the water supply in far west Texas comes from groundwater. That's according to data from the Texas Water Development Board. And yes, ranchers have been sinking wells on their land for decades, if not centuries, but now some big landowners are breaking up their properties and selling those smaller parcels off to newcomers. Newcomers, of course, need water too, but whether there's enough to go around? From West Texas, Zoe Kurland reports.
Out in the ghost town of Terlingua in remote West Texas, craggy mountains loom high in the distance, largely uninhabited save for a few houses dotting the hillside. But today there's a change to the landscape. A drilling rig cuts into the horizon, spewing dark shale into the air. Kate Killingsworth owns Arrowhead Drilling. As he drives up to the rig, he says they'll probably have to drill 1,000 feet today to hit water. But even then, there are no assurances.
You just don't know exactly what to expect here. Hopefully find the water.
Statewide, since the beginning of the pandemic, more people have been moving out to rural areas. And in far west Texas, where municipal water supplies aren't readily available, the first thing newcomers have to do is drill a well. Killingsworth, a third-generation well driller, does a lot of that work. So he sees the risks for new property owners firsthand.
If I were to buy a piece of property, I myself would want to know whether that's sustainable or not for me to drill a water well.
Lately, Arrowhead has been getting calls from all over. But as more people drill wells in the desert, Killingsworth says there's no way to know that the water will last.
I'm not going to build a house there if I know that there's already too many wells on this place and we're not able to know if we have water in the future or not.
Local groundwater districts say that individually, small wells don't make an enormous impact. But local water officials are concerned about the growing number in West Texas. Summer Webb, the general manager of two of the local groundwater districts, says she's been approving new wells daily.
What's happening is you're getting a lot more wells in an area that we don't necessarily want to see so many holes in the ground.
However, groundwater districts are continuing to issue the permits. It's the age-old issue of population growth in Texas versus shared resources, says Robert Mace, a hydrologist who studies rural groundwater use in the state.
As people are buying property, they're putting in wells, and there are more straws going into the aquifer.
By straws, he means more water users.
That's just going to add more stress to the aquifers.
Mace recently authored a study showing that Far West Texas groundwater is currently being pumped to its limit. And wells are already going dry, which means landowners have to make their wells deeper, a costly process, or drill a new well entirely. However, Mace says that drilling deeper isn't a sustainable solution.
At some point, you do reach the bottom of the aquifer, and you may have to go to a deeper aquifer if one exists. And there may not be one that exists. And so at that point, you don't have a water supply anymore.
The state's water laws weren't written with the expectation that this many people would ever live in the desert. That's according to Amy Hardberger, a water law professor at Texas Tech. She says that Texas land management was built on the assumption that ranchers with large properties would be good stewards of the land.
Because, they do have this dependency on the land working.
To address the issue, some groundwater districts are trying to pass rules to limit the number of wells allowed on small pieces of land. However, regulations can only do so much. Hardberger says that the region is in the midst of a huge culture shift, and she says local officials need to send new residents this message.
We cannot, not we will not, we cannot change our ethos to meet what you were used to in a much more lush area, or none of us will be able to remain here.
Hardberger says as desert land parcels get smaller, the state's responsibility to inform new residents grows larger. Texas must make the realities of desert living clear to its inhabitants before the water runs out. In West Texas, I'm Zoe Kurland for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the small business version of the very macro problem that Jay Powell and the Fed are working their way through. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said today in its Small Business Index that 63% of small businesses have increased their prices over the past year. Makes sense. 40% of them have cut staff. Also, I suppose, to some degree, makes sense. Here is the arguably more troubling part. 45% of small businesses say they have dealt with inflation by taking out a loan. You take out a loan, you have to pay interest. The Fed is making noises about interest rates going up next year-ish. You can see, I think, where this gets tricky. All right, we are out of here. Not, though, without your moment of economic context. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. It is not just your imagination. The food industry market research company Data Central says 60% of restaurants have reduced the number of items on their menus this year. Still, and all just because we do need another inflation data point today, I think, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says the Consumer Price Index for food away from home, which does include restaurants, up 5.8% over the past year. Okay, now we're really going. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.